Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Austin Chadwick, and this is Chris. And taking a look at our Kanban board, we've covered just sharing, diffusion of innovation, servant leadership, extreme ownership. And next up is the Satir change model. So to get us going, Chris, what does that mean to you?
Yeah. Okay, so the Satir change model, if you haven't heard about it, is a family therapy originating idea that comes from Virginia Satir, who was a family therapist. And in her research, she has created a model for dealing with any sort of change in a system, or at least visualizing the steps that teams or families or anything go through. And this has been widely accepted now in kind of the business space. And so the Satir change model is kind of this idea of a late status quo, essentially the current status quo, and then introduction of a foreign element, and then a period of resistance, and then a decay in maybe performance or things working well, and then a slow climb to the new norm. And so it's very interesting to describe this in both terms of organization. This is why scaling is really hard on teams. Mm. And so I wrote an experience report a number of years ago about scaling the mob. And one thing that we were doing was we were hiring two people a month.
Wait, you were hiring two foreign elements a day?
Yeah, two new people each month. And what was happening was, culturally, given the Satir change model, right, for example, and it took me a while to come to terms with this, but given the Satir change model, you can't hire two people a month and still expect to maintain your culture, right?
Yeah.
And so, especially from a team of five to a team of 27, right?
Yeah.
And so that meant that you'd go in and introduce the foreign element, which is the new person, and then it would drive your performance down. And then that would be, you'd still be climbing up when you introduce the new one, and then your performance would drive down again. And so over and over again, it would cause damage to the system. This is why things like turnover is really expensive. This is why big organizational changes cause irreparable shifts in culture and things like that. And so next time you're planning your big migration into the next big, trademarked agile practice, you might consider the Satir change model and look to go to a more iterative approach to doing those things. And so... But it's important to note that, in any system, the Satir change model applies. And you can see the introduction of the new element, the new foreign element, as referred to by the actual model. And performance will go down for a while until you've actually gotten used to each other, something like that. This is usually human interpersonal systems in general. But that might be... the way that a department's laid out, that might be an org structure change, that might be anything related to even a new working agreement you might have. And so you might say, hey, we're going to wash the dishes in the sink from now on. Well, so that might go well, that might not go well immediately, but there might be some static around that as you make that initial change until it becomes the new status quo. And then once you're in the new status quo, then you might be comfortable to make another change at that point again. But
yeah.
I think in my mind, and I don't know if there's research around this, but in my experience, the Satir change model will compound, right? It will get worse and worse every new change you make. And so a large series of subsequent changes, like hiring people over and over and over again and not letting the team norm, will eventually lead to more or less the destruction of what was originally there, because it'll just keep going down and down and down. But I use that kind of mentally to just understand when, maybe it's time to build a new culture, build something new, or continue working on the existing culture because things can be repaired, right? That sort of
thing. Yeah. Well, I have a little bit to share on that, and then I have a follow-up question kind of hearing what you're talking about that on that. And so being a foreign element myself, recently I have some experience with, and it is good to know coming in that, like, hey, foreign element's a little bit of a strong word, but to know, like, hey, I'm going to mix things up when I, if I join a team,
yes,
what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so to expect that, and I think emotionally to kind of prepare yourself to see that happen and not to be like, oh, this is amazing, you're here and everything works perfectly now that you're on the team. Thanks for joining us. You know, yeah. That, you know, anything I say or introduce or just even being present is going to cause this ripple effect, right? And yeah. So being cognizant of it so you can see it kind of degrading, and I'm guessing you'll help it, if you're more of aware of it, you can help it recover quickly or find the new norm quickly, or is there, is there a way to speed it up, or is it, you just kind of face it and know we're going to ride this out and...
Yeah, I mean, so being aware of these changes, so like if you're joining a new company or a new team, like one thing that I really like is from Esther Derby, she talks about the center enter turn model, and so looking that up would be good. But the idea of when you enter a team, don't just go in and try and change things, right? That's the way that you encounter the most resistance, and I think that's evident in the set your change model, because if you look at graphs of the model, you'll find that there's a period where that foreign element gets introduced, and then there's a lot of resistance to that. That's where corporate antibodies come in and things like that. And so the fastest way to make people dislike you on a new team is probably to go and try and change their processes right when you join. And so the center end of turn is kind of a model to say, okay, I'm going to come in and I'm going to understand how people act around me, and I'm going to go with the flow for a while and become part of the team. That's the enter, right? Is essentially now you're understanding your surroundings. And then the turn is, okay, now that I'm part of the team, and now people are willing to listen to my suggestions and buy in a lot into what I have to say, then we can, you know, slowly convince to move in a direction. And that's it, whether or not you're a new leader in an organization, if you're a solo dev, if you're a mod programmer, I think this works in almost every situation, is, you know, becoming part of the team first will reduce the number of changes going on at the same time, right?
Yeah.
If you join a team and you have opinions about how things should be different, and then you try and change the way everybody else works at the same time, those are two changes, and those have two independent set your change models. And so you are compounding the effect, I think. And so the idea there is that you've already caused more friction than you could have had you just been, okay, I'm now part of the team, I'm trying to become more effective in the team, right?
Gotcha. So it's going to happen. I guess there's ways to more gracefully embrace this at to your change model, right? And so instead of coming to the team and they're like, oh, foreign elements telling me to do stuff different, you know, if you become part of the team and go with the flow for a while, it won't be seen so much as a foreign element. It'll be seen as like, oh, this is, you know, a peer I respect, and introducing an idea, or, you know.
In terms of the model, the foreign element exists. Like, that's no just matter a label.
What, yeah.
That's just a label of how those things happen. What you want to do is you want to reduce the number of occurrences in which it's one after the other.
Right.
And so, you know, you just want to space out the idea of changing their process, changing a team's process, and your arrival into the team.
So don't compound.
And so this is especially true if you're an agile coach. If you're all of a sudden, you know, you join a team and right away you just say, hey, everybody, we're doing unit testing today, and no one's done unit testing before, you'll just immediately be rejected. And in fact, you'll build bad blood going forward for a very long time. And so, so that, you know, that ends up being true in any case. And so your norm for your team now is your norm now, and it's bound to change, because it will be bound to be different at some time. But this is also true for results of retrospectives, right? You do a retrospective and you have a result. If you do another retrospective right away and then have another result before you've really understood what the changes of your previous retrospective were, then you're probably going to drive your performance down because you're changing too many things at once. And so just paying attention to the model and saying, okay, given every incremental change I add, don't stack them on top of each other as much as possible. If you can space them out either temporally or compartmentally, then you'll have a better chance at making each one successful. But if you say, we're going to start doing unit tests and continuous delivery, and we're going to refactor every day, and this is a requirement to everyone on the team, you're bound to fail, I think, because you didn't approach it in a way that actually can be accepted by the system. And so immediately everybody will just turn against you, and even then each of those practices will be done poorly, right? Rather than just doing one well, getting good at it. And the Satya, like if you ask a team who's never done unit tests before just to start doing unit tests, that's many months of dedicated practice and work to make that happen. And you're bound, if you add anything to that as far as changing the rest of the processes, it'll probably be harmful.
Yeah, gotcha. And I guess before we wrap up this episode and close it out, because we can probably keep talking a long time about this, there's a lot of meat here, so maybe we'll come back and iterate on this one again. But I'm just going to do a shout out to Arlo Belshees. He has like a agile engineering mind map kind of thing, but so I'll put a link to that in the YouTube description. But it shows from like start to finish the different stages to take people through, and it's like instead of step one being continuous delivery, it's step one, like if they're not used to working in teams, help them work in teams and get used to that concept of teaming, you know.
It's a breakdown of incremental progress in that area. So a big message that I like to convey in general is if you can make it incremental and space it out, then that's why Arlo's document is really great, is because you can look through that and have ideas about what the next smallest incremental change you can make is. And that's the thing, is like, you know, where we work now, it took us 7 years to get where we are. And so continuous delivery and daily releases and, varying degrees of interpersonal safety, like that took years to get.
Right.
And scaling the team, right?
Yeah.
And so we didn't do it all at once. If we did it all at once, we wouldn't be producing at all.
Right? Yep. Yeah, definitely. So check out that link for some more details on how to step through. And it even has like technical things like unit testing to the next thing, and even has organizational things. So I think we'll close it out for this episode. So have a good one, and until next time, see you.
Have a good one.